Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It's the first full day of Donald Trump being under indictment. Two of Trump's lawyers have just either quit or been fired. We're waiting to find out what's up with that. And it looks like Eileen Cannon, Judge Luce Cannon, has been assigned at least part of his case. And it looks like his valet, who was moving the boxes in Mar-a-Lago, has also been indicted on the conspiracy charge. We'll get to all that as the program progresses. Also, why billionaires hate Social Security. We'll get into that. And geeky science. They knew the earth would burn. And can this judge stop the GOP from playing doctor? So a lot coming up on the program today. The Harlan Crow plot thickens with mansion and cinema intrigue. We'll talk about that. Susan Cork is going to drop by. Where are the trends and threats of hate, of far-right extremism taking America? She's with the Southern Poverty Law Center. I do have a couple of stories I wanted to share with you and a rant for you. The first is Donald Trump's snidely whiplash moment. And does that look like the white power sign? We've got a picture of this thing. Donald Trump did his rant about, I've been indicted and I'm an innocent man, in front of a picture of a guy twirling his mustache with the white power sign going on with his hand. What's the deal with this? Is this grift just, like in his blood? Also, I got Donald Trump's email. This came like within an hour of the time that he was indicted. Thomas, we are watching our republic die before our very eyes. The Biden-appointed special counsel has indicted me in yet another witch hunt regarding documents that I had the right to declassify as president of the United States. The witch hunt began when the FBI raided my home and then staged it to make it look like a made-for-TV crime scene with police sirens and flashing red and blue lights. Actually, there wasn't any of that. Anyhow, it's filled with lies. I mean, it's just, and he goes on talking about, and at the very end, of course, it's like, please make a contribution to peacefully stand with me today and prove that you will never surrender our country to the radical left. Right. It is worth noting, I think, in the context of Donald Trump's snidely whiplash moment, that today is the 7th anniversary. Today is the 7th anniversary of Donald Trump Jr. meeting in Trump Tower with Natalia Veselnetskaya, the Russian lawyer who was sent here by Putin, along with Putin's hand-picked translator, Anatoly Samacharov, and two buddies of a Russian oligarch, Alice Agarov. The meeting started at 4:10, and at 4:40, 20 minutes after the meeting ended, for the very first time, Donald Trump tweeted about Hillary Clinton's emails. So, I mean, just consider this for a moment. Don Jr. and Paul Manafort, who worked for Vladimir Putin, setting up, you know, Yanukovych in Ukraine back in the day. Paul Manafort made, you know, Putin paid him $14 million. So, and he was, and he ran Trump's campaign. So here you've got a Putin agent running Trump's campaign. He's meeting with a Putin lawyer and a Putin translator in Trump Tower with Don Jr. And 20 minutes after this meeting, for the very first time ever, Donald Trump tweets about Hillary Clinton's emails. And ultimately, it was that scandal around her emails that, you know, most people agree caused her to lose the election to Donald Trump. Had that not been happening, then, you know, she would have easily, I mean, you know, she won by 3 million votes. I mean, the Electoral College and all that. But it sure looks to me like this entire thing was a Russian operation right from the get-go. I mean, literally right from the beginning. And, you know, this has just like gone down the memory hole. Why isn't anybody else talking about this? Why aren't they talking about this on MSNBC and CNN? Why, you know, today is the seventh anniversary of that meeting. And 20 minutes after that meeting with the Russian lawyer and the Russian translator and the two people who were there on behalf of the Russian oligarch who is best friends with Vladimir Putin, 20 minutes after that meeting, Donald Trump tweets about Hillary Clinton's emails for the first time. And yet nobody's talking about it. I don't get it. Okay. The other rant I wanted to share with you today is, one of several, actually, is Clarence Thomas. What do we do about this guy? The latest revelations. I mean, first, this started in April, right, with ProPublica discovering that Clarence Thomas had received over the last nearly 30 years, since 1994, millions of dollars worth of, or what appears to be millions of dollars worth of vacations and remodeling and buying and remodeling his mother's home and letting her live in it rent free and putting the kid that he and Jenny were raising through high-end prep schools at, you know, covering the tuition, that Harlan Crow, the son of Trammell Crow, the famous real estate developer, and now the billionaire, you know, CEO and or whatever his position is with all these different Crow holdings and Crow Industrial and Crow this and Crow that, you know, that he had, you know, it appears that he basically bought a Supreme Court justice and has owned him for the better part of 30 years. And then Lever News has just published an in-depth report about how Crow's companies are substantially, financially benefiting from Clarence Thomas's tie-breaking votes. The most recent and I think one of the more egregious cases was this case involving the Clean Water Act, where Clarence Thomas was the tie-breaking vote. Brett Kavanaugh even voted against this decision. But Clarence Thomas was the tie-breaking vote that ended federal protection of about half the wetlands in America at the same time that one of the Crow companies was trying to build a huge, apparently, warehouse complex of some sort in Georgia and was being held up because there was a wetland on there. Well, that's not going to be an issue anymore, apparently. So what do we do here? Well, there's really two options. You know, one is for there to be an investigation of corruption by the Justice Department of Clarence Thomas. That's not going to happen. And the other, you know, especially with Merrick Garland. And the other is to impeach him. And that's not going to happen. Impeachment has to originate in the House of Representatives, which is owned by the Republicans right now. And you know, no Supreme Court justice has ever been successfully removed from office. Samuel Chase in 1805 was impeached by the House, but the Senate failed to convict him. But there is a lesson from the 1970s, and that was the lesson that Richard Nixon taught us. When Nixon became president, the most liberal member of the Supreme Court was a guy named Abe Fortas. And Fortas's wife worked at a high-powered law firm in Washington, D.C., and there had been this claim back in 1968 when Lyndon Johnson wanted to make Abe Fortas the Chief Justice. Earl Warren announced in 68 that he was going to retire. And LBJ wanted to make Abe Fortas the Chief Justice, and this claim came out that Fortas's wife was somehow involved in some illegal or criminal tax scheme, and the proof of it was in the safe in her office. They actually looked into this in 68 and found that there was no merit. It was just a complete BS charge. But now Richard Nixon, you know, a couple of years later, Richard Nixon was president, and so he had John Mitchell convene a grand jury to investigate Abe Fortas's wife. At which point, now, you know, keep in mind, this was complete BS. There was no there, but still, the old saying, you know, a grand jury can indict a ham sandwich. Fortas, in order to stop John Mitchell from dragging his wife through the mud, resigned from the Supreme Court. Now, Ginni Thomas, in my opinion, has, you know, some significant issues that are worthy of investigation by a grand jury, shall we say. Number one is her involvement in the fake electors scheme. This is a clear, in my opinion, the whole fake electors scheme is a clear criminal fraud against the United States. In addition to being seditious and all those other things, just, you know, faking government forms is a crime itself. And, you know, I'm expecting to see some significant prosecutions around this coming out of Jack Smith. We'll see, you know, where it all goes. But, you know, this is an issue because Ginni Thomas sent letters, email letters, to a majority of the Republican legislators in the state of Arizona, essentially asking them to watch a YouTube video. But the call for action of the YouTube video is apparently to participate in the fake elector scheme. She also sent, you know, similar notes to members of state legislatures, state legislature in Wisconsin. Then there's also her involvement with the January 6th rally. Now, you know, she left, or at least she asserts that she left before any violence began. And she asserts that she was not one of the organizers, but one of the people in the middle of the whole thing who worked for the group that had the permit for the Ellipse, said that she was, that Ginni Thomas was the person who basically negotiated among the various warring factions to bring them together and make the January 6th rally happen. And that has never been seriously investigated. So I'm saying that, you know, Merrick Garland needs to convene a grand jury. Now, I get it. Merrick Garland is so timid and so afraid of doing anything that might be perceived as political that for 2 years he ignored the blatant criminality of Donald Trump until finally the January 6th committee shamed him into appointing Jack Smith. Well, you know, this summer, it looks like Jack Smith is going to nail Donald Trump and probably a couple dozen other people. My prediction is going to be it's not just going to be Donald Trump. It's going to be 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 people. It's going to be a bunch of people that he's going to be going after. I mean, we'll see. I may be wrong, but that's how Robert Mueller did it. You'll recall Robert Mueller indicted some 30 some odd people, 37 people, as I recall. The majority of them, I think 27 of them were in Russia. But he actually got convictions. I mean, out of the Mueller investigation came the conviction of Trump's first campaign manager, Paul Manafort. So anyhow, bottom line is, I think that this would be a way to, number one, show not just Clarence Thomas, but the other members of the court who are living high on the hog right now, Justice Roberts, his wife making $10 million, you know, hustling lawyers into law firms to argue before the court, and who paid off Brett Kavanaugh's, you know, gambling debts and stuff like that. What's going on with Sam Alito and his luxury trips to Europe? There's just a bunch of questions here that are worthy of investigation. But start with Ginni Thomas, in my opinion. So number one, it tells them, you know, corruption is something that will not stand. Number two, it has can shed some light on the ability to shed some light on actually what happened behind the scenes in the organizing for January 6th, if it turns out that Ginni Thomas wasn't directly involved with that. And third, it might provoke Clarence Thomas to do like Abe Fortas did and say, you know, this is just not worth the trouble. He's in his 70s. He's a wealthy man now, and no doubt in part thanks to Mr. Crow. And, you know, it's time to pack it in, Clarence. So, you know, we'll see where that goes. But I am actually hopeful about this. And that's the piece that I wrote today over at HartmanReport.com. It's titled Time to Investigate Ginni Thomas. It's also posted over on Daily Kos. So there's that. Two other stories that I wanted to share with you very quickly that I think are just absurd. The shameless greed of Big Pharma. This is just incredible. Merck became the first pharmaceutical company to sue the Biden administration over Medicare being able to negotiate prices. Now, they only gave Medicare the ability to negotiate prices in the Inflation Reduction Act on, I believe, 20 different drugs, or maybe it was only 10. It was a small number of drugs, a very small number of drugs. But even that is making the pharmaceutical companies go crazy. They filed a lawsuit against HHS and CMS saying, and this is from Merck's lawsuit, that the negotiations, quote, make a mockery of the First Amendment by conscripting companies to legitimize government extortion. And they're asking the court to, quote, declare that the program affects compensable takings under the Fifth Amendment and enjoin its compelled agreements under the First Amendment. Patty Murray, the Democratic senator from Washington State, says Merck is doing everything it can to protect its profits at the expense of patients who need their prescriptions to stay healthy and get treatment for everything from cancer to diabetes. Yeah, very true. On top of that, now we've got the healthcare system. The CEOs of the seven largest health insurance companies took $335 million in compensation last year. That's just mind-boggling. One guy took $181 million, the CEO of Molina Healthcare, and all of their money comes from taxpayer-funded programs. These guys, it's a gravy train for these guys.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Why Billionaires Hate Social Security, my colleague Richard Eskow, who works out of our Washington, D.C. affiliate, wrote this just absolutely brilliant piece. It's published over at commondreams.org. Consider the billionaires. What makes a person a billionaire? Greedy, addicted to making money, obsessed with making money, which leads to bad behavior, surprisingly worried about the money they have, less empathetic and more self-interested than other people. Breakers of certain laws and social norms, less charitable on a percentage basis, very politically influential, and determined to cut Social Security. Richard suggests that the richer someone is, there was a study that was done, and I found that the richer a person was, the more they wanted to cut Social Security. Why? Because presumably they're more and more disconnected from, you know, grandma who's living on cat food. I mean, it's just they pay for think tanks and news outlets, Richard points out. And he says really what this is all about is distraction. He said they want to prevent the public from drawing a connection between Social Security's finances, the working class retirement crisis, and the ludicrous amounts of wealth that are held by America's billionaires. Social Security, he adds, represents everything the typical billionaire loathes, including community, solidarity, and the empowerment of the working class. And I think so. I think Richard Eskow has, or R.J. Eskow has absolutely nailed this, and done a fine job of it. I encourage you to get over to Common Dreams and read that piece. And I would add, President Joe Biden has come out and said, when he did his State of the Union address, you'll recall, he said, you know, there are some Republicans who want to cut Social Security, and they all started booing, saying, no. Remember Marjorie Taylor Greene waving her hands? No, we don't want to cut Social Security. Well, now they want to cut Social Security. He said, I'm so glad to see you guys agree with me. They were lying. Oh, surprise, surprise. Deputy Press Secretary Andrew Bates has blasted Kevin McCarthy for reneging on his plans for a revival of the so-called Cat Food Commission. The story that is in the news today, high-ranking Republicans have indicated they plan to erode the retirement benefits middle-class families count on. The majority driver of the budget is mandatory spending, says Kevin McCarthy. It's Medicare, Social Security. He said this on Fox News. He also complained that Biden had walled off Social Security and Medicare from cuts. So there's that. Then, in addition, the Trump indictment, there's a 49-page indictment, was just released. And it has some really interesting things. It says that he kept papers, boxes containing papers about, and this is a quote from the indictment, defense and weapon capabilities of both the United States and foreign countries. Now, if you don't think that Russia or Saudi Arabia would pay billions for that, and maybe did, well, let me read the whole thing, actually. He kept boxes containing papers about defense and weapons capabilities of both the United States and foreign countries, United States nuclear programs, potential vulnerabilities of the United States and its allies to nuclear attack, and plans for possible retaliation in response to a foreign attack. This is breathtaking stuff. Remember all the foreign spies? There was a Chinese spy, that woman that was sucking up to Donald Trump and following him around for several days there at Mar-a-Lago. And then there was several Russian spies as well, who always attractive women, because Donald Trump just loves to have them around him. The indictment goes on to say Trump, quote, caused scores of boxes, many of which contain classified documents, to be transported to the Mar-a-Lago Club in Palm Beach, Florida, where he maintained his residence. Nothing that he had was, he was not authorized to possess or retain those classified documents. He stored his boxes containing classified documents in various locations at the Mar-a-Lago Club, including in a ballroom, a bathroom, a shower, his office space, his bedroom, and a storage room. I don't see how it gets worse than this. I mean, you know, his valet apparently helped him in all this, and he has been indicted now as well as part of this conspiracy. The indictment quotes from a text exchange between two unnamed Trump employees, quote, there is still a little room in the shower where his other stuff is. I mean, they were talking about where to stash his stuff. Walt Nauta, the valet who has also been arrested, or indicted, quote, moved 64 boxes from the storage room and brought them to Trump's residence. Joe Biden was asked about this. He said, I have no comment. Yeah. This looks like really serious, dangerous, deadly to the United States stuff that Donald Trump was leaving out in the open, where spies from China, Russia, and I believe he sold them to Saudi Arabia. I can't figure out any other reason why they would give Jared Kushner $2 billion and give Donald Trump hundreds of millions of dollars, which is what it appears he's gotten for the sponsoring the LIV Golf tournaments. So there's that. A couple of other stories I wanted to share with you. We have a geeky science. Never forget, this is a great piece by Haricot Blue over on Daily Kos. Never forget, they knew in 1959, Edward Teller, the father of the atomic bomb, wrote, and this was a symposium of petroleum industry executives that he was speaking to. He said, when you burn conventional fuel, you create carbon dioxide. Its presence in the atmosphere causes a greenhouse effect. If the world keeps using fossil fuels, the ice caps will begin to melt, raising sea levels. Eventually, all the coastal cities will be covered. 1940 friggin' nine. 80 years ago, they knew in 1968 when a report commissioned by the American Petroleum Institute concluded, quote, significant temperature changes are almost certain to occur by the year 2000, and these could bring about climactic changes. There seems to be no doubt that the potential damage to our environment could be severe. Pollutants, which we generally ignore because they have little local effects, CO2 and submicron particles, may be the cause of serious worldwide environmental changes. You know, and the article just goes on and on and on, you know, quoting from study after study after study. You can find that over at dailycos.com. And then finally, this is from Aaron Reed's brilliant Substack newsletter. If you are a member of Substack, well, you don't even have to be, actually. Aaron, E-R-I-N, aaroninthemorning.com is the website for this. And a judge in Florida has blocked Ron DeSantis's horrible anti-trans legislation. And I just have to share with you a couple of quotes. His name is Judge Hinkle. A couple of the quotes here. The defendants say, in effect, that the organizations were dominated by individuals who pursued good politics, not good medicine. In other words, the argument that DeSantis is making is that doctors who are providing care to people undergoing transition are doing it for political purposes rather than medical purposes. And the judge just calls them out and says, that's a lie. He goes on to say, this is the judge, there has long been and still is substantial bigotry directed at transgender individuals. This is from the court ruling. A Florida legislator's remarkable reference to transgender witnesses as a committee hearing as mutants and demons is one of his examples. He said that is, as noted above, the elephant in the room. The Republicans also, in pushing for this law, said that a lot of people who make a transition, a gender transition, regret it afterwards. And that almost never happens. The judge, in fact, called that out. He said, regret is rare. Indeed, the defendants have offered no evidence of any Florida resident who regrets being treated with GnRH antagonists or cross-sex hormones. None. They couldn't find a single person in Florida who regretted going through a transition. He blew up their parental rights argument. He said parents should have if they want to support their child in going through a transition, they should be able to do so. In other words, the nanny state is Ron DeSantis. And I think most importantly, he said gender identity is real and is separate from sex. I just have to read this to you because it's just so brilliant. He said, with extraordinarily rare exceptions not at issue here, every person is born with external sex characteristics, male or female, and chromosomes that match. As the person goes through life, the person also has a gender identity, a deeply felt internal sense of being male or female. For more than 99% of people, the external sex characteristics match the person's gender identity. For less than 1%, the natal sex and gender identity are opposites. A natal male's gender identity is female, or vice versa. The elephant in the room should be noted at the outset. Gender identity is real. The record makes this clear. The medical defendants, speaking through their attorneys, have admitted it. Bam. I mean, this is solid, solid stuff. John in Cambria, California. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I just have a question for you, Tom. Given what the judge that has just been appointed to Trump's case, Judge Cannon,
right.
Again,
right.
Given that what she did last time when she had his case, is there anything that can be done to, you know, get someone else to hear this? Because she's clearly biased.
Yeah, I get that, John. And she was overruled by, an appeals court. Two out of the three judges who overruled her were also Trump appointees, and they said she was nuts. I mean, they didn't literally say that, but you know what I'm talking about here.
Right.
I'm not sure that this is more than just a paperwork thing. I mean, she represents... She sits about 100 miles north of Miami, and this is going to be right. In the Miami court. She was a participant in a previous case that directly related to this. She was the one who ruled that there should be a special master to review all the documents that were taken out of Mar-a-Lago. And
right. She was trying to delay it.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that was the whole point. She was dancing to Donald Trump's tune. There's no doubt about that. But I think it's because she was previously involved in the case that her name is included in this document. I don't think that she's going to be the judge that they hear this before. But, I'm not a legal expert. I'm just looking at the geography here. She
you know, sits 100 miles away. The other judge, and I'm sorry, I don't have his name right in front of me, but who also has ruled in parts of this case in the past, who is more inclined to follow the rule of law and has not been, you know, super friendly to Donald Trump and was not a Trump appointee. He was also named as a judge in this case, and he is in Miami. So I'm guessing that it's probably going to be before him. But let's hold off until Tuesday before we get all, you know, upset about this, because I think this may be, you know, a tempest in a teapot. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot, John.
Thank you.
Good talking to you. Lowell in Salem, Oregon. Hey, Lowell, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. You've always said that, you know, those who do not learn from the past are condemned to repeat it. And I was wondering if sometime in the future you could look back at this time period and compare it to the McCarthy era and tell us how similar these appear to be. Because, you know, there's been some release like the Hamilton 68 that showed that quite a number of accounts were falsely labeled as Russian, and which remind me a lot of the McCarthy waving an empty briefcase claiming he had proof of communists.
What accounts were falsely labeled as Russian? Are you talking about on Twitter?
So the Hamilton 68 project where they
I have no idea what
labeled
that is.
Accounts as Well, that was part of Matt Taibbi's reporting on the Twitter file.
Yeah, but Matt Taibbi's reporting has been virtually completely discredited.
I think you'll... unfortunately, MSNBC is not the best source at this point in time. That's why I was wondering if in the future you could look back at this time, because there was such hysteria.
I think that there is a parallel.
During the McCarthy era.
You know, setting aside Matt Taibbi, I think that there is a parallel in as much as what McCarthy was doing was driving a moral panic around communism. Now we've got a moral panic around trans people. We've got a moral panic around LGBTQ, around all these, book banning and all this other stuff. I think that's probably the closest we can get to a parallel, Lowell. Lowell, thanks for the call. We'll be right back. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, all into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. It's accessible from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/Hartman with two N's. netsuite.com/Hartman. That's netsuite.com/Hartman.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
And on the line with us is Susan Cork, the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project, co-author of The Democracy Playbook, a resource to fight authoritarianism and strengthen democratic resilience. SPLCenter.org is the website. Also, that's the Twitter handle, and Susan's personal Twitter handle is Susan Cork, C-O-R-K-E, number one. Susan, welcome to the program. You guys just released a report, The Year in Hate 2022, looking back at last year. And I understand there were 1,225 active hate groups in America?
Yes. Thank you so much for having me on today, Tom. And I wanted to note, as a native of Concord, Massachusetts, I appreciated Ralph Waldo Emerson.
Okay.
His words ring true today. Yes, we documented 1,225 active hate and anti-government extremist groups across the United States in 2022.
Put that in context. What does that look like in, say, the scope of the last 20, 30, 40 years?
Sure. The number is relatively flat from last year. Last year, there was 1,221. So what I would say is a shift we've been making is an understanding that the landscape of hate and extremism has changed with the rise of the influence of the internet, that it is less necessary to be a card-carrying member of a hate and extremist group. So I don't think that the flatness of the numbers this year tells that much of a story. I think the interesting parts are when we dig into the different subsections. You know, for example, notable retreat on the anti-government side of the listing is in the militia movement, that this year we identified 61 active militia groups, which is a decline from 92 groups identified in 2021. And what this shows is that this reduction is largely the result of members and leaders being held accountable for their role in the deadly January 6th attack.
Oh, interesting.
That's notable. On the one hand, the Oath Keepers, you know, have really, their organization has really been crumbling as a result of historic convictions. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the Proud Boys group has seen a growth in membership. So the problem is still dire, but there has been a real shift in that area of the report.
What are the different categories of hate groups that you're identifying?
Sure. And that's how my department is organized. So we think of it in different categories, but we have the white power and white supremacist, white nationalist groupings. We have the anti-government extremist groups, which includes militia groups and conspiratorial anti-government groups. And then we have what we kind of loosely call the groups that are trying to impact the mainstream in particular with their hate and extremism. So groups that are primarily anti-LGBTQ, anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant, and others. So
anti-Semitic.
Anti-Semitic as well. So the similarity is that there's a connective tissue of white supremacy that is unifying amongst these groups. There is a large degree of shared belief in the white supremacist great replacement theory, which is quite racist and anti-Semitic. The difference, so it's a directing and othering on the hate group side, those for their immutable characteristics of race, gender, religion, sexual identity. And then on the anti-government group list, it's seeing the U.S. government as illegitimate, fomenting conspiracy theories aimed at undermining the U.S. government, you know, militia groups that view themselves as the, you know, rightful authority. So that's kind of how we think about the different groupings.
I realize that in these different categories, there may be different nuances of motivation. But broadly speaking, I mean, this has been a debate for a long time in America, whether, for example, have hate groups risen in the last 40 years because Reaganomics has reduced the American middle class from 2/3 of us to 45% of us. And there's a backlash, you know, white people seeing their economic power vanishing and assuming or being told that that's because black or brown people are taking that power, as opposed to you know, realizing that actually it's billionaires taking their money and their wealth. But, you know, what are the that's one theory. You know, another is that, you know, it's just good old fashioned hate. Another is, you know, religious extremism. What are the principal drivers of these hate groups?
Well, I mean, you have kind of nailed part of it, that the great replacement theory, which, you know, disturbing, we did a poll last summer and shows that I think the number was about 7 out of 10 Republicans believe in the great replacement theory, which is exactly as you described it, that there's this belief that America's growing diversity is a problem, that hordes of non-white immigrants are descending upon this country. That's where you get a lot of the hyperbolic invasion rhetoric coming out of mainstream right now too, and far right. So this belief that white Christian America is under threat from these hordes of non-European, non-white people in our country, and they see diversity as a threat. They prefer to return to in America before the civil rights movement and seek to enforce that in different ways. And some of the nuances that you're talking about are also a nuance of tactics, right? So, you know, on the really far right, we have the groups like the neo-Nazis, Ku Klux Klan, the more extreme groups that seek to use violence as the tactic that, you know, a disturbing percent, I think it was 20 or 25% see that we're headed towards a civil war. And there's a growing acceptance of violence as an approved and effective means of getting there. So that's the more violent edge of this movement. And within all of these groups that we're tracking on the far right, there is, we've seen in the past couple of years, this coming together in a movement around some of these shared beliefs that, broadly speaking, fall under the tent of white supremacist ideology. The Great Replacement Theory, protecting America for white America against diversity, is uniting.
Right. We had, you know, on this program, one of the kind of cardinal characteristics of this program, and during at least during its first 15 years, the last 5 years, it's been increasingly difficult to get conservatives to even come on and talk to me. But, you know, I used to debate Republicans and conservatives all the time on this program. I thought it was, you know, illuminating for people at the very least. And there was one guy, Sheriff Mack, who used to come on all the time, who was affiliated with the Oath Keepers and was one of the co-founders of the Constitutional Sheriffs or something like that. And, you know, I got it. I mean, in fact, I met him in Perry. He came into our studio in D.C. a couple times, and he was broke. I mean, he was a true believer. This was a guy who actually believed what he was saying, that the government was illegitimate, that only sheriffs were the legitimate authority. Quack, quack, quack. Mm-hmm. You look at him on one end of the spectrum, and he was out there, you know, promoting this, you know, basically hate. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you got people like Pat Robertson, who just passed away today, who was a billionaire when he died, who in my mind was just essentially a professional grifter who had weaponized hate to make money. And, you know, how much of what's going on with the promotion and promulgation of hate and hate groups in America is being done for political power or money versus, you know, genuine ideology?
Well, if we go back a ways, I mean, a lot of where we are today has been planned out from the powerful and the wealthy behind the scenes. That there was, you know, the rise of Trump for SPLC, you know, the rise of the far right and the hate-filled ideology, you know, unfortunately for us, was not a surprise. We'd been warning about it. And so to drive America in a more conservative direction, the fear around the growing diversity in America, that was powered by wealthy interests. There was a deliberate strategy to mainstream that ideology and bring the GOP further rightward.
Is that just, I mean, simply like the old cartoon of, you know, the rich guy sitting there with 20 cookies in front of him and a poor black guy with no cookies and a poor white guy with one cookie, and the rich guy says to the white guy, he wants your cookie? I mean, is that basically what's going on with that?
I mean, you know, I mean, that is kind of the populist, you know, the populist, you know, playbook. But I, yeah. What I would say is it's a little more complicated than that. So same time, we had the rise of the internet. And, you know, while it was seen initially as, you know, the great equalizer, the great hope for democracy, what we found out is that has not borne out to be true, that it is very easy. And those on the far right, you know, saw that this could be a way to really achieve the aims of mainstreaming hate and extremism and radicalizing, using it as a radicalizing force. And, you know, there's been a certain amount of complicity, which we've seen over the years with the tech companies, Twitter and Facebook.
In particular,
In seeking profit. So to your point about, you know, the profit motive, you know, there was profit in going after the, you know, the most outrageous, controversial material. Was driving profits right for those organizations.
And we saw that at Fox with Tucker Carlson. We have about 25 seconds till we hit a hard break here. What can Americans do other than going to SPLC Center or SPLCenter.org and signing up with the Southern Poverty Law Center? What can we do about this?
That's a great question. One, public education has been under attack. We need a big push for inclusive public education. Two, we need to start working more on prevention. There needs to be a greater investment by public and private into community resilience and preventing radicalization. Three, it's very important that officials and leaders use their platform to speak out against hate and extremism and to draw the line and push extremism.
That's great. Susan Cork with the SPL Center, the Southern Poverty Law Center, one of the great organizations. Hang on just a second,
this
Susan.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
That guy always steps on me. Susan, thank you so much for being with us today. It's great talking.
Yeah, thank you. Great interview. Appreciate
thank
it.
You. Thank you. New reporting about Harlan Crow and his wife, Kathy. They're not just Republican megadonors. I mean, they've contributed millions of dollars to Republican candidates and campaign committees over the last three decades, according to OpenSecrets.org and Federal Election Commission records. But it turns out that they're also, this guy is a canny political operator. He understands American politics. I mean, it's no wonder that he's been able to keep Clarence Thomas in the correct lane for the last 30 years by, you know, giving him multi-million dollars in vacations and Frederick Douglass's Bible and buying his mother's home and refurbishing it and letting her live there rent-free and, you know, putting his kid through high-end prep schools. And, you know, it's really pretty breathtaking. I mean, but, you know, he does this, obviously, because he knows what he's doing politically. And why do I say that? Because he's not just giving money to Republicans. He is also giving money to some Democrats, but not just any Democrats. He gave money to Joe Manchin. Joe Manchin blows up the, you know, refuses to blow up the filibuster so that the voting rights bill, the, you know, H.R. 1, the For the People Act, can't pass. He gives money to Kyrsten Sinema. Same deal. Kyrsten Sinema helping blow up the Build Back Better plan also in the United States Senate. He's a mega donor to No Labels, the group that is thinking about running Joe Manchin for president in order to help, you know, whoever the Republican nominee is become president against Joe Biden. He has also contributed to a bunch of Democrats in the House, Carolyn Bordeaux of California, Ed Case of Hawaii. These are all sellout Democrats. These are all Democrats who take big money from corporations and right-wingers. Jim Costa of California, Henry Cuellar of Texas, Jared Golden of Maine, Vincente Gonzalez of Texas, Josh Gottheimer of New Jersey, who's always out there saying, I'm a problem solver. Yeah, right. And Kurt Schrader of Oregon, the guy that we got rid of here. The National Republican Congressional Committee also reported receiving over $1.4 million from the Crows. And they contributed $500,000, $500,000 to Liberty Central. Who started Liberty Central? Ginny Thomas. Gee, what a coincidence. He's also given money to Senators Chuck Grassley, John Cornyn, and Marsha Blackburn, who all sit on the Judiciary Committee that has now subpoenaed Harlan Crow to come testify. He's paying off his jurors. Does it get worse than this? I suppose it's possible, but wow. Let's pick up some phone calls here. Tom in Huntington Beach, California. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind today?
Hey, first I wanted to thank you for inoculating the masses with the vaccine of truth and knowledge.
You're welcome. I like the metaphor.
And,
thank you, Tom.
Yeah. I really wanted to comment on your disclosure about Harlan Crow. And I was wondering, because these things are public knowledge, and those three people on the Judiciary Committee that received money from him.
Right. Yeah. Blackburn the old guy from Iowa. Today's my day to have brain farts. I'm sorry. I'd have to pull the article out. But yeah, Chuck Grassley.
Yeah. But I wanted to know, because of that public connection that's already a fact, could that be used to show a massive conflict of interest and at least get those three recluse from the Harlan Crow interrogation interview and let three other Republican hitmen who don't know what they're doing get in there?
I don't think that if you had a recusal in a Senate committee that there would be a replacement. The committee's pretty much.
Oh, that's better yet.
Yeah, I agree. I doubt that, Grassley and Blackburn and whoever the third person was, but in particular, I mean, you look at the things that Blackburn has been saying recently, Marsha Blackburn, just blatantly, neo-fascist, racist stuff, the stuff that, these guys have no shame. I don't think that they will recuse themselves. I do expect the Democrats to point out the fact that they're on the take from Harlan Crow. But
that's good.
You know,
did you know that the Southern Poverty Law Center just yesterday declared Moms for Liberty an extremist group?
Yeah, that was one of the things that I was going to mention to Susan, and I never got around to it. I had a long list of questions for her. I thought that was great because, you know, Moms for Liberty has been basically the leading group that has been promoting book bans. You know,
exactly.
You know, which is just basically hating on gay people and black people by and large, other people of color as well. So
yeah, and some of them don't even read the book.
Yeah, and most of them, I think. Yep, great point.
Yeah,
thank you very much. I appreciate the call, Tom.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Our book today in the Tom Hartman Book Club is Stolen Focus by Johann Hari. The subtitle, Why You Can't Pay Attention and How to Think Deeply Again. This is from the introduction titled Walking in Memphis. When he was 9 years old, my godson developed a brief but freakishly intense obsession with Elvis Presley. He took to singing Jailhouse Rock at the top of his voice with all the low crooning and pelvis jiggling of the king himself. He didn't know this style had become a joke, so he offered it with all the heart-catching sincerity of a preteen who believes he's being cool. In the brief pauses before he started singing it all over again, he demanded to know everything, everything, everything about Elvis. And so I jabbered out the rough outline of that inspiring, sad, stupid story. Elvis was born in one of the poorest towns in Mississippi, a place far, far away, I said. He arrived in the world alongside his twin brother, who died a few minutes later. As he grew up, his mother told him that if he sang to the moon every night, his brother could hear his voice. So he sang and sang. He began to perform in public just as television was taking off. So in a sudden swoosh, he became more famous than anyone had ever before been. Everywhere Elvis went, people would scream until his world became a chamber of screams. He retreated into a cocoon of his own construction where he gloried in his possessions in place of his lost freedom. For his mother, he bought a palace and named it Graceland. I skimmed through the rest, the descent into addiction, the sweating, gurning stage jammering in Vegas, the death at the age of 42. Whenever my godson, who I'll call Adam, I've changed some details here to avoid identifying him, asked questions about how the story ended, I got him to duet Blue Moon with me instead. You saw me standing alone, he sang in his little voice, without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own. One day, Adam looked at me very earnestly and asked, Johann, will you take me to Graceland one day? Without really thinking, I agreed. Do you promise? Do you really promise? I said I did. And I never gave it another thought until everything had gone wrong. 10 years later, Adam was lost. He had dropped out of school when he was 15, and he spent literally almost all his waking hours at home, alternating blankly between screens. His phone, an infinite scroll of WhatsApp and Facebook messages, and his iPad on which he watched a blur of YouTube and porn. At moments, I could still see in him traces of the joyful little boy who sang Viva Las Vegas, but it was like that person had broken into smaller, disconnected fragments. He struggled to stay with the topic of conversation for more than a few minutes without jerking back to his screen or abruptly switching to another topic. He seemed to be whirring at the speed of Snapchat, somewhere where nothing still or serious could reach him. He was intelligent, decent, kind, but it was like nothing could gain any traction in his mind. During the decade in which Adam had become a man, this fracturing seemed to be happening to some degree to many of us. The sensation of being alive in the early 21st century consisted of the sense that our ability to pay attention, to focus, was cracking and breaking. I could feel it happening to me. I'd buy piles of books and I'd glimpse them guiltily from the corner of my eye as I told myself, just one more tweet. I still read a lot, but with each year that passed, it felt more and more like running up a down escalator. I had just turned 40, and wherever my generation gathered, we would lament our lost capacity for concentration, as if it was a friend who had vanished one day at sea and never been seen since. Then one evening, as we lay on a large sofa, each staring at our own ceaselessly shrieking screens, I looked at Adam and felt a low dread. We can't live like this, I said to myself. Adam, I said softly, let's go to Graceland. What? I reminded him of the promise that I had made to him so many years before. He couldn't even remember those blue moon days, nor my pledge to him. But I could see that the idea of breaking this numbing routine ignited something in him. He looked up at me and asked if I was serious. I am, I said, but there's one condition. I'll pay for us to go 4,000 miles. We'll go to Memphis and New Orleans. We'll go all over the South, anywhere you want. But I can't do it if when we get there, all you're going to do is stare at your phone. You have to promise to leave it switched off except at night. We have to return to reality. We have to connect with something that matters to us. He swore he would, and a few weeks later, we lifted off from London Heathrow toward the land of the Delta Blues. When you arrive at the gates of Graceland, there's no longer a human being whose job is to show you around. You're handed an iPad, and you put in little earbuds, and the iPad tells you what to do. Turn left, turn right, walk forward. In each room, the iPad, in the voice of some forgotten actor, tells you about the room you're in, and a photograph of it appears on the screen. So we walked around Graceland alone, staring at the iPad. We were surrounded by Canadians and Koreans and the whole United Nations of blank-faced people looking down, seeing nothing around them. I watched them as they walk, feeling more and more tense. Occasionally, somebody would look away from the iPad, and I felt a flicker of hope, and I'd try to make eye contact with them to shrug, to say, hey, we're the only ones looking around. We're the ones who traveled thousands of miles. The book Stolen Focus by Johann Hari. And welcome back. I just retweeted a tweet I sent out yesterday about Richie Mann. Richie Mann, R-I-T-C-H-E-Y-M-A-N-N. Richie Mann is one of the volunteers in our chat room on YouTube and has been for many years. He was attacked and he's been on and off homeless for years. And he was attacked by a man with a metal pipe. Hit him in the face, knocked his teeth out, and landed him in the hospital. He has no money, no resources. We put up a GoFundMe page for him. Nicholas, our chat room moderator, put it up. And if you'd like to help a guy out with his medical expenses, who is a genuinely good and decent person who has fallen in hard times and just was horribly attacked. Check out my Twitter feed, Tom, THOM_Hartman with two N's on Twitter. And it just says, this is our chat room moderator fundraiser by Richie Mann. Or you can go over to GoFundMe.com and search Richie Mann, R-I-T-C-H-E-Y-M-A-N-N. It'd be nice to help Richie at the very least cover the expenses that he's now facing. So picking up your calls here, Gary in Alpharetta, Georgia. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Thank you.
My pleasure. Greed has no heart.
Hello. Well, yeah, and greed to me, and then I'm going to get to the subject very quickly. Thank you. Greed is not only money, but greed to me is two things: how you treat other people and how you minister our government. And right now, we're not doing a good job of it.
Yeah,
it's just my opinion.
I'm with you.
And the subject I called about was America's democracy and republic, in my humble opinion, we're on the ropes. I think we'll get it better. We'll get it done. But we're on the ropes right now. We got to recognize that.
We're definitely under assault.
We're on the ropes for one reason. The rule of law. Mm. The rule of law. That has to be our destiny.
Yeah.
That's our number one priority, and it's all playing out now. Today's the day we saw what's happening in the news. That must be our destiny, to teach our children that the bottom line is the rule of law.
Yeah.
Yes, the economy is important. So other things are important in your life. But overall, for everybody's welfare, the rule of law is the top priority, and it's playing out as I speak right now.
Yep.
And we all really know it.
I find it absolutely fascinating that Trump is being prosecuted first for stealing national security secrets and possibly selling them to other people before he was prosecuted or is prosecuted, or maybe instead of being prosecuted for trying to overthrow our government. I think trying to overthrow our government is a much bigger crime, but, you know, I think they're going for the low-hanging fruit.
I do, too. In other words, you're saying, and I agree with you, if you're saying that January 6th is the biggest crime, I agree with you.
Yeah, that's definitely what I'm saying. It's definitely.
All right, Tom, thank you.
All righty, good talking to you, Gary. Thank you for the call. Tim in Swansboro, North Carolina. Hey, Tim, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to bring this up. I was so infuriated with the PGA Live merger.
Yeah.
But then I thought after yesterday for Trump, the best of times, worst of times, all in a matter of days for him.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not a done deal yet, by the way. There is a substantial movement to oppose this, and there are multiple lawsuits trying to oppose this merger, suggesting that it's not legal. I'm not sure that they would succeed. You know, these are private entities, and they should, you know, generally speaking, be allowed to do whatever they want. But I think that there's a very good chance that that merger... Not a very good chance, but I think there's a chance that that merger won't happen. So we'll all have to keep our eye on that. Tim, thank you for the call. And my apologies to everybody else who's on hold. You know, there's always next week. And thanks so much for calling in today. Special thanks to Louise Hartman, Sean Taylor, Nate Atwell, Jamie Holly, Joyce the Hammer, Nance, Nigel Peacock, Sue Nethercutt, Patrick Hoyt, Gerilyn Halbert, Ron Hartenbaum, Chase Spross, Nicholas Miller, Pat Sweeney, Jay LeBlanc, Al Gorilla Rhythm, Connor Arroyo, Carna Verde, our friend Richie Mann, who has, you know, been beaten, who is our, you know, one of our moderators. Thank you to all of you, and please help out Richie.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.